Blog Talk Radio.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome to A Time for Justice. Yes, A Time for Justice is a show on the Elevated Places Network, and we would like to welcome you tonight to our show. Thank you so much for calling in, tuning in, because we have a great informational show for you all tonight as we talk about some serious needs that the community has to look at, which is serving the needs of youth and families. Thank you again. My name is Sister Pamela Muhammad, and I am an attorney, and I welcome you to our show, A Time for Justice. This show discusses legal and current events in a roundtable discussion with legal minds and minds in the community and people who work in the community tonight. We're going to discuss the country's centuries-long failures to apply, uphold, and enforce the laws and the overall failure of the legal system to give justice and the negative impact failures have had on Black people and their Black families. Ultimately, we want fair dealing. We want justice under the law, but all too often, this is not the actions that we see. Our guest tonight will not make those excuses for racist conduct often seen, which are really just distractions from the truth, which is the path to justice and equal protection. So let's talk about just, fair, and equitable solutions, which are in the best interest of the people. So tonight, again, our topic is kinship and serving the needs of Black youth and families. You know, we thought this would be appropriate tonight as we look at, you know, the overwhelming issues as our families are in triumph because we are here and we love one another and we are striving to unite with each other. So we don't want to just not say that there's not a lot to strive for because we're winning. But we also want to look at the fact today is Giving Day in the non-for-profit world. And so we thought that as Black people, we need to talk about self-preservation, self-determination, and how we serve the needs of our communities and how we can do even better jobs. So tonight we have some really great guests. Our guests tonight, let me go ahead and bring them on. The first guest, I'm going to open up her mic, is Sandera Mallory. Now, Sister Sandera is a social worker, and she actually is a member at large of the National Association of Black Social Workers, and that is, as I said, a national organization, and she's a member at large. I think they're a very interesting organization, and she's going to share some of that with us. Sister Sandera is a just she has such a wealth of information and experience toward clients and mobilizing and facilitating changes, their functionality, their wellness, their growth and development. She is a retired social worker supervisor. Sister Sandera also is specialized. She actually worked at Children's Protective Services, and she's worked in family-based safety services. And she now has her own company, which is called Mallory and Consultants. Sister Sandera is a member also of an organization with me called the Coalition for the Preservation of the Black Family. She's a graduate of the Louisiana State University. She did graduate work at social work at the in Houston, I think at University of Houston, yes. And so there's just so much I could say about her, National Black Child Development, you know, and the CURE, which is a coalition of urban resource experts. She's just, like I say, wonderful, wonderful person. She served as a guest lecturer at Texas Southern University. So I'm going to go ahead and open up her mic because she's really a special friend and just a hardworking sister who we love to welcome to our show tonight. So let me go ahead and open up Sister Sandera's mic. And Sister Sandera?
Yes, Hotep family. Oh,
Hotep.
I'm so excited to be a part of this opportunity tonight, and I bring you greetings on behalf of the National Association of Black Social Workers, where I serve currently now as a recording secretary, Pam. I've moved to another level now, but I am part of the team that is about the business of our families, our communities, and our children. So I'm so very thankful to be here to enjoy sharing thoughts and ideas with others about how we can make our families whole and productive. So thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, ma'am, and thank you, Sister Sandera. I want to go ahead and open up the other ladies. We have another sister joining us tonight, and I'm going to open up her mic. Her name is Sister Faraha Taha, and she's known by the community as Mama Faraha. That is a title that she takes seriously and strives to uphold. The community in which I serve attached a label that is full of respect, expectation, and love. She says, I strive every day to make sure that I am exemplary of the title given to me. She goes on to say that she is the proud mother of three and a BB of six. Her occupation is that of a nurse presently. She's a school nurse for Jack Yates High School, and like the label of mama, she says she takes the label of Nurse Collins just as seriously because, once again, it's one of service. Sister Faraha has been connected to activism since she was 13 and found out that Jesus was black and that my people were not born on a slave ship. And so she goes on to talk about how she knows she comes from kings and queens of Africa. And I'm going to go ahead and say that she's a proud member of the National Black United Front, serving the people, she says, our people, each and every day. Service is the highest praise. So let me go ahead and open up Sister Faraha's mic, another sister that I've known for quite some time. Sister Faraha.
Hey, how are you this evening?
I am fine. Yes, ma'am. It is so wonderful to have you. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, Sister Faraha. I appreciate you calling
in.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Thank you. And please give the greetings to the members and community of the National Black United Front. You know, we really appreciate all that you all do. Yes, ma'am.
Yes.
Okay, and so
working hard every
day. No, go ahead.
I said just working hard every day.
That's right. Yes, ma'am. That's right.
Yes.
So last but certainly not least, I want to bring on our brother. And our brother is Jihad Hassan Muhammad. And Brother Jihad's bio reads as follows. Brother Jihad is a widowed father raising children. He has also been a journalist for such media and newspapers as the Dallas Weekly, of which he was the editor for many years, the Texas Metro News, the St. Louis American, and the world-renowned Final Call newspaper. Jihad is an author and overall creator. He was the co-founder of Dynasty Hip Hop Mentoring Program and has since worked with Radio 1 Dallas, Hip Hop Station creating She Represents, an on-air segment that promotes the respect and overall greatness of black women, which is a alternative from the norm, often seen and heard through the industry of hip-hop. As a youth advocate working along with mainstream hip-hop radio stations, he continues to push creative ways to uplift youth and promote conflict resolution on the airwaves. So let me go ahead and open up Brother Jihad's mic. Brother Jihad.
Yes, ma'am. Yes,
well,
yes. You hear me?
I can hear you fine. Yes, sir.
All right.
Assalamualaikum
to you, Brother Jihad. Salam and Hotep to our sister Sandera and Mama Saraha. I think it's, please let me know if I'm wrong. And just thankful to be on the air with you guys and share.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Yes,
yeah,
thank
so thank you.
You.
Yeah, thank you again so much. And excuse me, that's one thing about radio. We don't see each other, so y'all have to forgive me if I talk and you're talking. So we're going to try to get that right. But I want to open up the conversation. Again, we're talking about kinship and serving the needs of youth and families. Now, kinship is a legal term, and we're going to get to that. But we want to open up by saying that American racism has placed black children in an especially disadvantaged position in relation to American institutions. So I want to just start off by discussing some of what we're doing to try to make communities decent and safe places to live. And let's start out by identifying maybe what are we seeing as the condition of our families in need in these communities? Does anyone want to kind of start that conversation? And I mean, that goes in the schools. We're talking about the communities. I guess some of the traumas that people are experiencing because of the pandemic, or, you know, COVID leaving us with some, I know the violence that we're actually seeing being portrayed in the media. I mean, those were some opportunities I wanted to give you all to kind of weigh in off the top with any comments or concerns. Yeah.
Well, I can start a little bit, Pam, as Sister Pam, Sister Sandera. I've seen a variety of movements for our families, but the biggest struggles and some of the challenges that I continue to see is the lack of cohesiveness within our family. And I hate to think that we would not want to continue to build forward, but because of a variety of dysfunctional systems that I think that we have been exposed to over these many, many years, from education to juveniles, injustice, I can't call it justice, but injustice, and our medical systems and all of the housing and other variety of systems have not been able to meet the needs of our families and our children, and that ends up affecting children who can no longer either remain in their home because our families have been overwhelmed with these other systems of injustice, and for a variety of reasons, our children are removed from their home and not replaced, as I would like them to see, back into their environment to grow and to heal. So I continue to stay frustrated about the kinship system that is a part of the foster care system here in the state of Texas. I can speak on that. And I would love to see our families become whole and productive, but we have so many factors that weigh against us, that it's really difficult for us to get a leg up, a hand up, a movement up. But I see the negative influences that are impacting our families so very often, and it really ends up rolling into the families, and it distracts, I think, from families being able to provide decent and safe places for our children to live. So that's one of the things that I've been experiencing in the foster care system.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for that. Did someone else want to add?
Yeah, I think, too, that it goes back in history as to, you know, our neighborhoods. You know, every time we've had, in different cities, we've had black businesses that were thriving, and they were always, always torn up. You know what I'm saying? And so, and they were put in projects. So we've been a project for a lot of years, you know. And I was doing a program about what happened in Detroit. I'm from Detroit. We had a place called Black Bottom. They called it Black Bottom. It had over 300 businesses that belonged to us. It had 1,500 homes, and they put freeways through it. Our children have really never seen the children today have never really seen a black thriving community. They have never seen black businesses. They've never seen a lot of positivity with just black people. You know, that's very rare in some communities, and definitely here in our communities, our children are faced with food deserts. They're faced with housing that's not good housing for them. They're faced with a lot of things, and then we ask them to be educated. Then only thing they can think is positive is the negativity. And so I think, you know, changing that, we would have to want to, like, we talked about Kwanzaa, we talked about Kujichagulia, building for ourselves, growing for ourselves. Our children must see something different, and I think that starts with us. They must see a positive community in order for them to want to be a part of it, you know, or want to continue to let it grow, because they are our future. So we have to show them something different. We have to show them positive businesses, you know, black people actually doing for ourselves and, you know, educating our own and so on and so forth in order for them to feel good about it, because all they see is what others do. All they see is what others give us. And they think that that's it and that we don't have anything, but that's not our history. We are a strong people, and they need to see the strength that we have.
Yes, ma'am. And Brother Jahab, before you weigh in, I think that's one of our issues for tonight, because we're uniting with our families, you know, you all in the grassroots communities, we in the Nation of Islam, and we have certainly all struggled to build, and we have the positive models, and we have those of us who are working in the communities, and we've got leadership. And so we know that, of course, because of the high rates of incarceration, poverty, some of the negative influences from drugs, you know, poor neighborhoods, as we're saying, those are some of the issues. We also know that integration has been a, you know, served the death knell, whereas the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, of course, he was one of the people raising the voice against integration. But, you know, here we are from the Nixon targeting in the community all the way up through Reagan, and today we're seeing families that are poorer than their grandparents, older relatives with young children. We're seeing deceased parents who are in need, and we're seeing drug-addicted parents. And, you know, again, a lot of that had to do with that war on crime, that war on drugs, you know, these failed social programs, whereas, you know, some of us would say, too, you know, that separation is the solution.
It's never a problem until it happens to them. Now, drugs has been here, so is alcoholism and so forth. You know, and then all of a sudden, it's an epidemic because it faces them. But our people have been fighting it since they put it into our community.
Oh, no, you're right. Okay. You're right.
Okay.
So the solutions, like you say, to the problem looks different when whites are now suffering, and you're seeing these diversion programs in courts, whereas what we've seen is harsh punishment and incarceration. So, Brother Jihad, if you had an opening that you wanted to share with us, I know you've worked in the community for so long. Did you want to give us some of your input?
Yes, ma'am. Jihad. Yes, ma'am. I thank y'all so much. Can y'all hear me?
Yes, sir. Very
yes,
well.
Sir.
Yes, sir. Right. Yeah.
I thank y'all so much, and I appreciate everyone's work on the line. Looking at the, I don't want to say front lines, but nevertheless, I'm going to use that term. First of all, Assalamu alaikum. And I'm so very thankful be able to share, and thankful for my upbringing as a 14-year-old in St. Louis, Missouri, where I'm from, and now in Dallas and in other cities as well. As a 14-year-old, it was hip-hop and its culture, which is different from the industry of hip-hop, and perhaps we'll delve into that maybe later, but the culture of hip-hop that gave me a message, and as a 14-year-old in St. Louis, Missouri, and then later as a 16-year-old when I was blessed to join the Nation of Islam as a 16-year-old under the leadership of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. It was through hip-hop, okay? And so this culture is always going to be fun for me because of its massive uplifting and life-giving power. Nevertheless, though, we know, you know, when something is in the wrong hands, like a good medicine in the wrong hands, or getting too much of it can be lethal and fatal. The culture of hip-hop, when put in the wrong hands and mutated and caused to do other than what it was meant for, when the Almighty Zulu Nation under African Bambaataa and the elders in 1973 put together this culture of hip-hop, which was used to resolve conflict in the streets of New York City. And that time in 1973 was one of the most violent cities in America, if not the most violent city in America. So hip-hop was utilized in the parks and in the jams, you know, with the DJ and then next to MC and then next to graffiti and the breaking, et cetera, et cetera. Those elements to unify us so that we could, you know, do something, so that we could unite under a banner of the beats and the rhymes and have a good time and stop conflict, murder, and bloodshed. Well, now we're in 2021, okay? And, you know, seeing that we have a vicious and merciless enemy who utilizes this culture and mutates it to, you know, what it is now, and it is being utilized to give messages. Now, let me be clear. The messages are not the root of the problem, okay? Oftentimes, okay. Throughout our sojourn in history, we say, oh, and, you know, parents, they, you know, in the 90s and 80s and different times, people were throwing away tapes and putting bulldozers over them and burning tapes and things of that nature. That's not to say that some of this stuff may need to, you know, in what it's doing. I understand them burning it. But nevertheless, you know, a wicked enemy has gotten involved and mutated such, and now we are left with those who utilize it just to get their friends, well, their family and their uplift, and now utilize it to get economics for their family. And it has to be done a certain way to get the economics, and it has to be drugs. It has to be the destruction of one another, or as I used to say, the op, you know, the op is the opposite person, you know what I'm saying? So we utilize this term often. You'll hear it on radio. Man, I was shooting at the ops, or I was doing it. That's your rival, you know, that's the opposite camp, whatever, who, what have you. And so, you know, we utilize these things. And so how does this trickle down into the system where our children, you know, didn't have, or didn't, there was no one to talk to because the grandmother is younger, or she's not around, or the mother's not around, or they're in the system.
Right.
And so the message that they're hearing 13, 14, 15, 16 times an hour, whatever, is this message. And so we have to look at that, and we have to, you know, decipher these messages in that message. And so that part about it is the culture, or the death culture, that our youth experience while in these systems, which take them further into the system, which, you know, it seems to be a cycle, if you will. And so that's the perspective that I want to shed any degree of light, if I'm blessed to tonight, as you all are on the front lines in these systems fighting for our babies, if you will. So that's what I want to say right now.
Wow, thank you so much. Yeah, because when we talk about the system, we're talking tonight about kinship and what is in the child welfare system. And many of you all have heard us talk about the foster care system and how it railroads black children into negative consequences, you know, destroying black families. And what we talk about is the surveilling of black women to the extent that they call it now the new Jane Crow. You know, we talk about the money-making machine that is the system where the children who are being, as Brother Jihad said, maybe they're neglected, maybe they're not being looked or so. We've got a wicked system that's targeting our community, and that's one of the things we wanted to talk about tonight as we talk about solutions. So let's start off with kinship. Now, what we see in the child welfare system is the fact that the courts are intentionally keeping children from connecting with their families. And when I say families, I'm saying, well, maybe that individual single parent or potentially the father may have the child. They may be going through some struggles. So what about the great-grandmother? What about the grandmother? What about the auntie? What about the play cousin? What about these extended family members that, like Sister Faraha said, for eons, black community has been taking care of our own? You know, there's no one more charitable than the black community when it comes to taking care of our children, our families. But this particular system of child welfare, they denied the children the right, and they're intentionally doing this. So I wanted to just start off by talking about back in 2008, we did a national agenda as part of the Million Family March, I believe it was. Yes, the Million Family March. And Sister Sandera, the National Association of Black Social Workers, did a report on kinship. And they talked about the significance and how traditionally families have depended upon support from other family members. And so we live in a child welfare system. Can you tell us a bit about whether or not the system supports kinship placement and some of the problems that we see from that?
Well, I will be the first to tell you, Sister Pam, I have worked over 30-some years in that child welfare system, and I did not see the level of support given back to our families who were, of course, under stress, underfinanced, and unable to really produce the things that they needed to do based on the other adverse systems that were pulling against them. But no, CPS system has not been one that I viewed as a positive support for our children. I was reading within the last couple of days with issues that come up with accidental incidents that happen in the home, and because many times the caseworkers are young, inexperienced, and rushed, if that's one of their reasonings, and overwhelmed, which is not an adequate reasoning for not doing a thorough assessment or an investigation to an incident that happens in the home. But instead, what we find is a lot of these young and unfortunately anglicized caseworkers get involved, and they end up removing our children on a whim or on adverse information. And unfortunately, our children end up lingering and languishing in foster care for those 18 months that the courts will hold them. And then they become more finalized in the system, which is the part that really has frustrated me over the many years, instead of looking and seeking reliable, viable, and nurturing caregivers, either that be biological relatives, kinship placements, as what we, and many of you may have heard the term fictive kin, which means a person that is not a blood relationship but has known the family, is connected to the family, and still can meet the needs of the child. So what I have found is that the system has been always adverse to the needs of the child, and especially the needs of the family, of rehabilitating and reconciling children back to families of origin. So that's been a real frustration for me over the many years, and that was one of the reasons that the Coalition for the Preservation of the Black Family was created, because we saw the adverse effects that our children are being exposed to, because they come into a foreign system, uncaring, unloving, and I hate to say it, but it's true, racist system, and I've been in it for many, many years, so I can speak on it. I can definitely speak on it. And that system is not a parent, and that is never a place for a child to be raised. So I will just leave it right there, Sister Pam, and you can expound on it, but it's definitely not the place I think our children need to be nurtured to grow and to develop in. This is supposed to be a system of protection. It is not a system of protection, and I found that in a variety of different experiences, from the babies all the way up to the adolescents. It is a system of warehousing, and it is definitely not one that provides the nurturance and the training and education and the development that I think our children need. Our children need family, and that's what I think that we need to do. It's been missed. And for a variety of reasons, the courts are not in our favor, and they are definitely not looking out for the best interests of our children. So I'll throw that back to you and see if anybody else has any experiences with CPS and
kinship. Okay. Yes, ma'am. And please, callers and listeners, if you have a question or a comment, please press the number 1 to get into the host queue if you have a question or a comment. Because as you were saying, Sister Sandera, and it kind of echoes Brother Jihad's point, 15 to 18% of the cases where children are taken from the homes is because of, it's not abuse, it's really what we call neglect. And
neglect.
So, see, this is where, you know, this neglect is where the children, they sit at home listening to maybe music that's not uplifting to them. But real quick, I just wanted to talk about some of the issues that people see in court. When we talk about they are targeting families and they're not even respecting the nuclear families and giving them a chance to take the children home, the thing that really just boggles my mind is why would you use state resources when you had functional families? And so in an article that we saw on nextcity.org, they were talking about how grandparents not given a chance to talk in court, parents not getting a chance to talk in court. They try to repeat answer questions, and they're interrupted by the judge.
Mm-hmm.
They're limited with their ability to speak. Verbally abused by judges. Judges verbally abuse these parents and preventing them from speaking. This one judge, she was accused of having parents arrested illegally for contempt of court, which that's what happens when you talk out of turn. They can arrest you. You know, someone said in the article that this is not a one-judge problem. It's a system-wide problem. Now, again, these are the families that are coming to court to try to rescue their children.
Mm-hmm.
Like the grandmother said in this case, she said, we took real good care of those children. She really misses being able to cook for them and do other things.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the children that are coming into these systems and then being sent out, damaged, sent out, into the sex trafficking, sent out learning how to steal and maybe, being cold-hearted. So I just wanted to bring that out. You know, you had cases where children were abused in one foster home, and rather than you know, the child, okay, maybe now we can get the child to come to the home with its family, the judge would say, well, no, that's absolutely not even on the table, and we can't even consider it, and they won't even allow it to be talked about. So if this isn't slavery, I don't know what is. And we've even had those situations in Harris County where the judge will write on the paperwork, do not move, which means, under no circumstances am I going to allow this child to be moved from perhaps the foster care placement, which in many times it may be a black family, black children in white homes. So, you know, these are some of the situations that we see in the law that feeds into, I think, what you are seeing, Sister Faraha, sometimes in the school, Brother Jihad, when you all with your programs trying to reach children. So I wanted to throw out here adolescent brain development. When we look at how the children are also at risk on these streets and some of the ways that you all find them, Brother Jihad, maybe in your programs and being impacted by the negatives of sometimes the rap music. Sister Faraha, I know as the nurse in the school, you probably, you know, you're familiar with some of the conditions that the children, you know, they're just being preyed upon with their youth, in their youth. And their families.
Definitely.
So,
yes, most definitely. It's really prevalent in the schools, unfortunately, you know. It's hard to learn, you know. And we expect them to achieve, you know, on a test that's not prepared for them anyway. But it's like they have to go through so many things, and then we want them to come and learn. They have to go through the fact that they may not have a meal, to go through the fact that, you know, they may not have the uniforms, they may not have this and that, and then we expect these things for them to have at school, and then the peer pressure on not having those things that they see on television or that other children have. So it's a lot, you know. So, and we not even speaking about the we did a piece called Africans United for Sanity Now, and we dealt with you know, our teenagers and mental illness. But a lot of that is from all the stress and the things that they have to go through. Peer pressure now is different from the peer pressure we had back in the day. You know, they have social media is the peer pressure. I mean, it's just, you know, and our children are faced with a lot. So in expecting them to grow from all of that, it's very difficult, and that's what I see. You know, some children come, they say, Nurse Collins, I just want to talk, and I have to let them do that. You know, I have to let them be able to open up. They need that where they can open up, you know, and feel like somebody's listening, you know, to them. So it's very difficult. And then we want, on top of that, we want you to learn. And then we push college, you know, instead of pushing trades and things. It's just a lot for them to go through, you know, and our expectations are high. When, how are you going to want a high expectation when you haven't given them the foundation to reach the high expectation? So.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Yes.
Brother Jihad. Yes, sir.
I think, yes, just to echo the sister's reality and what she has seen. I think all of us have seen similar realities. You know, I think it's we have to look at everything that's affecting these children, whether it's the 70% or so single parent homes that, you know, is usually headed up by a mother, no father present. You know, the peer pressure, as my sister said, and the greatness of the pressure from the social media, from the media in general, because music is a form of media. These ideas are coming from a form of media, whether it's TV, radio, movies, whatever, what have you, social media. And so that world, you know, that now finds a lot of our youth, you know, with depression, you know, because of the comparison you know, the comparison syndrome, so to speak, of things that they see in media, whether it's social media, whether it's, you know, via the music, via, you know, movies, what have you. You know, I have to have what they have, and I'm really depressed because I'm comparing my life to them, you know, and they got stuff, and, you know, of course, all of this is it's a fallacy on some levels, you know. All the stuff you see is all the glitter, it's not gold. You know, nevertheless, though, it enhances an already detrimental situation, whether they're in the system, in a single-parent home, have inadequate education, which so much of many of our children have in the school systems, et cetera. So you just have a conglomeration, so to speak, negative and toxic gumbo, if you will, a smorgasbord of issues that affect our children. And that's why, you know, all of our different solutions, you know, are needed. We would often in mentoring ask children, you know, in our sessions, how many of them, you know, have a mother, I mean, have a father at home, and it would be dramatically, you know, more than half of them may not even know their father. You know, then the next is how many live with your grandmother? A lot of them live with their grandmother, you know, and then so these things, and of course it's not her fault. It's not, you know, she has to work a certain amount of hours. There are no, you know, little to no after school programs, the things that a lot of this funding could be utilized for. So we have seen a lot of different things in our sojourn and helping our children. And now, you know, as far as the airways are concerned, you know, these constant images being projected, which help to the decline of our youth because they want to mimic these images, so to speak, which are not real, you know. And so when a judge, you know, the judge, the system sees them as monsters, you know, if you will, menaces, as the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan taught, you know, when Minister Society was out, you know, and it just came out, you know, the world seeing us as menaces. Of course, there were some aspects of the movie that you know, spoke to the truth of our situation. But why, though? Why, you know, is it put out in that way so that the world can see these little menaces and monsters, and monsters and menaces are supposed to be destroyed, you know? And so that is what is being projected, you know, and it goes back to the, you know, to those judges and people of that nature that's, you know, that's perpetuating these dangerous situations.
Yeah. But then, too, you are so correct. But then, too, we have to go back to the history again. You know, the thing that happened to us as the black people was the separation of our families.
Right.
That was beginning of our destruction because, well, and so when you destroyed the black family, you did a lot because there were nothing but families together in the home, going through hard times and good times together, but still growing. But when that was separated, that was the beginning of the destruction of our families, which caused a lot of rifts in our world as black people. You know, because it was brothers and sisters who ran away and found each other as families. You know what I'm saying? When we were enslaved,
right,
as Africans enslaved. So, yeah, and so, you know, that kind of thing. So we always have to go back to that history as to why things happened. So when you understand the history of why things happened, you can understand how to actually either try to work on it and deal with it. And the fact that it's portrayed that our families aren't together, which is not true. There's a lot of black men in homes. There's a lot of black fathers out there doing a whole lot of good things. We need to uplift our black men. We need to uplift our black families that are actually out there doing things. All we hear is negative, that the black family is not together, black family's not doing this, and black. That's not true. I see so many. I know many, many beautiful black families. I know many, many beautiful black men who are in the homes, who are taking care of their families the best that they can. And those kind of things need to be uplifted. Because every time somebody comes on TV, all they want to show is somebody who's, well, my father ain't in the house. My father ain't here. But they don't ever show a black father doing a thing. And if they want to show a black father, he's married to a white woman. And, you know, on the TV and stuff. So, you know, so it's like our children need to see that because they exist. Our black men are out there. Our black men are out there doing it good. You know, and those are the things that need to see that. So the imagery, I think, needs to be changed in order for our children to see something different and believe that, hey, look, it's black families doing, you know, doing it and doing it big. All black families aren't doing bad, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that the imagery definitely needs to change, and it's up to us to do that. So positiveness to our children.
Yeah.
Positiveness. No, positive institution.
Yes, ma'am. You're right. And I know with the Coalition for the Preservation of a Black Family, one of the things we say is that black families that work can do more than any government agency or social service organization to help heal our communities. So as we're talking about building these black families, that's, you know, that's what we're looking at. But I think we also have to look at the actual wicked conspiracy that has really, you know, it's running through our community. And it's, in my mind, when we talk about our families and the way the courts sever the family ties, you know, make decisions over black families, it's really reminiscent of slavery, where the chattel slavery that black people supposedly were property, we have to really gauge how far have we really come from that. So we can look at solutions, because at some point, what is it that we need to do to break free and to actually build our own communities? And that's just, you know, that's a thought that I
have. Well, that's
very
powerful right there. That's very powerful. All praises
to Allah.
Because when you put it in that perspective like that, you know, you're right. We are still being put on the auction block. You know, we're put on the auction block when you put it that way, most definitely.
We talked about that a variety of ways, y'all. Remember, we talked about the systems not being in our best interest, from housing to criminal to education to medical.
Right.
It is all set up for us not to proceed. But we have to make our families believe that they can do better. And I know that if they get out of some of these systems, they definitely could do that.
Yes, ma'am.
Right.
Yes, ma'am.
Can I say one thing?
Yes, ma'am. Go right ahead.
During Harvey, I will say, during Harvey, I saw something beautiful. I saw black groups from all over the world come to our rescue. It was amazing.
What was Harvey? Make sure you tell
me. Hurricane Harvey.
Okay.
Hurricane Harvey.
Yeah, so during Hurricane Harvey, the National Black United Front was a hub for community to send things, people to send things and to come and volunteer and to help families all over Houston like that. But it happened that black groups came from all over the world, groups that I never heard about. That lets me know that we're together. We're just separated. We need to figure out how we put that glue together so we can get these, because we have the same like mind. We understand the issue. It's getting together. And I thought that was so beautiful, you know? Absolutely beautiful. And it was a beautiful thing to see. It was like a well-oiled machine, you know? People just coming in doing it. You know, and they weren't from here. They were from all over, all of the United States.
Right.
You know,
right.
Some parts of the world, different black groups. I said, I've never heard about that black group. Oh, yeah, we do this. We have a whole big farm over in South Carolina. We feeding people everywhere. Who knew?
Yes, ma'am.
You know?
No.
So that kind of thing, thing that we come together so our children can see positiveness. You know, like the Nation of Islam is doing, that the National Black United Front is doing, that SHAPE is doing, that people are doing all over. Our children need to see that, most definitely.
Yes, ma'am.
I agree.
I agree. So one of the things we're saying, so we have to stop looking at government agencies and look at our own individual abilities, our own group and collective abilities when we unite. And we know the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan told us to, you know, make our own communities decent and safe places to live. That's one initiative. I know here we talk about local organizing committees. We have operational unity. So people are actually talk to us about some of the farms that are some of the you know, you all do. I know you have a farm. I know Brother Jihad, and I want to put him out there because when we talk about fathering, Brother Jihad mentioned in his resume that he was the father, he's a widowed father. And the attempts that he made and the successful outcome that he saw when he was presented with the situation, I think is a very great learning tool. So Brother Jihad, would you share some of your experience with us? Because I know you wrote a book, so would you mind sharing with us?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Definitely. Well, I found myself in a struggle, if you will. My wife had passed, and then of course, we were like a black Brady Bunch, so to speak. She had children, I had children, and we were, you know, growing as one family. And then when she passed, I was left with those children, and we just rose to the occasion, helping each other, you know, everybody rolling up their sleeves and to move forward, you know.
Right.
Oftentimes, a lot of our children don't, or a lot of people don't understand what it is, you know, losing their parent at a young age. It could be, it's definitely a trauma, and it affects everyone differently. But just to make sure that, you know, working hard to make sure that they did not, you know, go in any other direction but a positive one, which is work for any parent in today's society. And that's been my, you know, somewhat of that sojourn, if you will.
Beautiful. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's really beautiful. Thank you. Thank you for sharing, that because, you know, it just made me think I love black family. You know, here we have a family that was able to maintain and actually thrive. And we can, as you're saying, Sister Faraha, we can do this because my question that I put out is what is our responsibility to serve? What, you know, this mindset that, again, you have to, we're just these broken people that unless the government can repair, you know, or even fix our problems, we're just at, you know, just at a loss. I think that's something we definitely have to look at and come out of. We can fix our own problems. And so I'm just asking, so what is our responsibility to serve? Sister Sandera, can you tell us a bit about the National Association of Black Social Workers? Anybody, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, thank you. We are a 54-year-old organization that came out of the renaissance for the civil rights era back in 68 when a lot of the organizations were being formed. We found that we are able, capable, and have the aptitude, attitude, and the resources to be self-sufficient. So we have been a self-sufficient organization for the last 54 years, not taking any grant money or looking to any other institution other than ourselves. So we have been around to empower, to uplift, to build families and children. We have several position papers that we put out, and one of them was on transracial adoption. If any of you have heard that term before, but back in 72, we were very opposed to white America, indicating that our children needed to be put in white homes. And our whole position at that time was that black families can take care of black families. We did not need them to be put and removed from the community. Now, they might not be able to be reared in the family of origin. But that doesn't mean our community cannot step up. That did not mean kinship could not step up. That did not mean fictive, which are people who are non-blood, church people, somebody that they knew and loved, could not step up. So our whole position at that time was allow us to do what is natural for us, which is to be whole and family. And we started that position paper, presented it to several of the legislatures during that period of time, and, of course, were brought up against opposition with white America who wanted our children. Many of you may not know that, but back in that particular day, white America was no longer able or wanting, because back at times, young whites were wanting to be career operators, and a lot of them were not having children. So needless to say, the second choice was to then remove children that were viable babies due to either drug issues that came into our community, and as you say, Sister Farad, that were placed in our community. The drug issues attacked our families, destroyed our families, and that made us vulnerable at that particular time, and children were put in foster care. And who were the first to go into white homes? Our babies. They were not allowing us to take our babies back, and they were putting various restrictions on us in order for us to regain our children. And they would have you, being that I was in that system, I know you could do a plan for almost 2 years and still not get your child out of foster care. So NABSW, which is the national component, there is a local entity here in Houston. We're always fighters about family needs, a family intervention, having a family be whole, and to ensure that our families could meet the needs of our own children as an entity of our own. So we have continued to fight that fight to advocate for best interests of our children, being with families of origin and being with families that can provide the love and protection that they need, and continue to be an advocate for families and children. So, but, yeah, we've been around for a minute.
Right. That's beautiful. And, again, it's about a black perspective and a black approach. And we don't need outsiders coming into our families, you know, because we know now about this bias, this racial bias, this white supremacist mindset that walks into black homes and says, you all are inferior. You know, we thought it before, we walked in your house, but now that we're in here, we really get to operate and make decisions. So, yeah, this is why we need to make our own communities decent and safe. And, Brother Jihad, I have a question for you. I didn't know if someone else wanted to, you know, chime in. But, Brother Jihad, my question for you, because I know some of your background with your program, you all did a program where you actually went into the communities and interacted with youth. And what about this issue where there's maybe a divide, or the enemy has forced the divide, created the perception? Is that something that you can give us any guidance on how to, you know, to look differently at the youth? What's your experience been with them? Are they as bad as what the media has portrayed? Of course.
No, ma'am. Our children just really need to know that somebody loves them. I mean, it sounds so cliche. This is not a Hallmark card, of course.
Yep.
This is not a Lifetime movie. But, you know, it is just that simple.
It's
and love
simple.
Love is
just
patient, though.
Mm-hmm.
Love is
mm-hmm.
patient, and love is enduring, though, too. So that don't mean that, you know, a person's going to immediately do what you want them to do and some of us may get upset because it's going to take some work, but that's a part of the love of it all. And so, no, we have seen hardened criminals, so to speak, you know, turn other than such. And when I say so to speak, that's the hand that has been dealt and the circumstance that has been dealt, and turn other than such by way of love and activity, you know. So that goes back to the imaging, though, that we have talked about. The image is to make us look, our children look like those monsters. That's the image, you know, to make them look like such throughout, you know, the media, you know, and that's the, and so that's what we're fighting against. And we say we have to change that imagery. Nevertheless, though, we have to change it to the people who are listening and who are looking at that as well, which is our youth. And in order to do so, it has to be done in a way that they're going to receive it. Oftentimes, we like to do things in our way as older, you know, as adults and older people, et cetera. And it may not be received if it's not delivered in a language that they can understand. And, you know, hip-hop and its industry is a language that is understood to them. So that has to be infiltrated. And one example of such is in Dallas, you know, Radio 1 Dallas, where I was blessed to be involved in and found a program, on-air segment called She Represents, which focuses on the respect and uplift of black women who are often seen in the industry, not the culture, but in the industry of hip-hop as bees and hoes and thoughts and et cetera, you know. So through talks, we were able to make the radio station see that we have to give some of that time up to refocus and show our little sisters who are listening to these things, you know, that black women are doing great and outstanding things. And so every segment is played in Dallas on 97.9 The Beat, which is two major hip-hop stations here in Dallas. And we're also working on doing something a little bit different, but doing something with Philadelphia Radio as well, you know, where, you know, to deal with some of the violence and conflict resolution. So we often say they need to get it, but it has to be delivered. You know, you can't deliver a message to a person who is not listening, and the message is not packaged for that person. You know, it has to be packaged for the people who are receiving it. So oftentimes we want to package it our way. And so our children don't want to hear nothing about nothing positive, per se, and I'm putting that in quotes. But, you know, it's made to look lame and you know, not cool, so to speak. They want to build that positivity, so to speak, to portray that. Then they see another way, and it becomes cool, for lack of a better term. So these are things that we just have to analyze, and the love makes you you know, look at different solutions and look at whatever it takes to get to the people you are trying to get to.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That's beautiful. Sir. Thank you. go right ahead. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, and so this is where, to me, that's why I believe that Kwanzaa is 365, because we're going to celebrate Kwanzaa, but each principle says what we're talking about tonight. We're saying umoja, unity, to strive and maintain a unity in our family, our nation, and our race. Kujichakadiya, to define who we are by naming ourselves, thinking for ourselves, speaking, creating for ourselves. And ujima, you know, to open our own businesses. Ujima, to maintain our communities and solve our problems together by taking ownership of each other's problems. Ujima, to open our businesses and to maintain and profit from them together for our purpose, develop personal goals, and then Kaumba, our creativity. Imani, our faith, you know, to believe in each other and everyone around us despite our struggles in our past. So, you know, yeah, so I think, you know, that those are the things that, you know, we need to, you know, to sit back on our principles and our goals and understand that we can work on those things together. And that's to build a strong nation within the nation, you know, definitely build for ourselves and work for ourselves. And let our children see something in Guzu Saba is one way, you know, that we can connect with our people by just having those principles and believing in them and practicing them every day.
That's beautiful. Yeah, because I guess, you know, another thing I was listening to Brother Jihad as well when he talks about this imagery that's being pushed through the music. And so when we look at, you know, the history and the law and the history of slavery and race, which is in the courts, but, you know, it's subliminal. It's there. It's the system of white supremacy that prohibited traditional family relationships for blacks. There's no legal recognition of the black slave family. Legally, blacks mm-hmm. not person, instead were property. No recognition right. of marriage, children, legitimation, and whites exercised total control over the slaves, yes. the education, the mates, and the children. And so I think we're at a point where we're looking at how to maintain control of our families, of our community, because all too often, again, maybe not directly, we're not seeing that we're still, you know, I think the Honorable Ms. Lois Farrakhan talks about how we live in, you know, it's not communities, it's not ghettos, but it's a colony, you know, where it's like we're controlled by outsiders. We live in these colonies, but we're not actually, are you know, my question would be, are we actually exercising total control over our children, their education? We talked a couple of shows ago about homeschooling and how during the pandemic there was a rise in homeschooling. And I think there were some positive outcomes. Many parents like the freedom. Wanted to throw out that Brother Jihad was talking about these mothers and maybe some of the children he worked with, how the mothers weren't home. And the stats say that moms work the equivalent of 2.5 full-time jobs, and the study shows that's about 98 hours a week. And so, again, we have to wonder who is exercising control over our families sometimes so we can even influence them with some of the positive, you know, things that we're doing, and again, tonight's show, I'm just saying that, you know, unity is powerful. We're taught that and expanding and, you know, pushing this message of self-preservation on to help each other. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Talk to us about that. This.
Yeah, like you said, I was a ICU nurse. And I worked 12 hours. I did not see my kids. Had my baby. I was like working. And it got to the point, I was like, all right, Creator, I have to see my child. You know, I have to raise her, become a school nurse. I became a school nurse so that I can be a mother to her because that, yes, I took a pay cut, but I gained something. I gained, you know, responsibility over my child. And so then I saw that the educational system wasn't working for her, so I put her in a homeschool setting. And I found it so beneficial. She got a chance to do things that, you know, that public schools, you know, weren't able. Then I saw it's a whole new world. There's a lot of universities that have homeschool dorms. Mm-hmm. And because they said the children are calmer. And then the public schools, yeah. That was, okay. Yeah, I think UT is one. Yeah, they said that the children are calmer. They find a difference in the children that are homeschooled. And so as she wanted to go back to public school, I was like, okay. So for her last few years, she went before graduating high school, she went back to public school, and they were like, oh, you think she's going to be able to assimilate? She did very well. She was at the top of her class. She graduated and went on to Sam Houston State. So, but homeschool, one thing they teach in the SATs, so our children could go and they grew. And, I put a homeschool up against any public schooler because they are focused. Everybody's worried about their social skills, but there's so many things. Texas is a homeschool state. So, you know, they have homeschool, intramural, everything, sport and all of that. And a lot of parents didn't know about that. They thought that public school was the only, you know, choice for them. But homeschool actually works. I've seen it work. I've seen.
Yes, ma'am. Well, you know, you and I, that's where we met, right?
Yeah.
You and I met. Our daughters were in homeschool together at one point.
Right.
And you know, we're happy. We know as Muslims that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the early followers, they went to jail to establish, you know, independent schools, you know, the early followers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad by, you know, starting our Muslim schools. And so now everybody, you know, we have the right. And I just think that is so beautiful. I totally agree with you. But Jihad, I've seen you in a homeschool environment once upon a time as well. So you can speak to, you know, the beauty of that practice. Yeah, it definitely gives so much value in our ability to just control our children's education. Yes, sir.
Yes.
Definitely. A lot of my children, some of my children were homeschooled, and my children in particular that I was left with were homeschooled, and it definitely you can see the difference. Oftentimes children are like, I don't know if I want to go here, you know, sometimes, you know, because it's like, they feel like it's a brave new world out there in public school and things going on, and then when they get to experience that, they, you know, they're like, oh, wow, you know, it's total anarchy out here somewhat, you know. So, you know, the way some of these schools, the public schools are being ran. But the homeschooling environment and independent education, and education in particular, like that of the MUI system that we have, Muhammad University of Islam system, which our children went to, and then, you know, its affiliates, you really see, you know, that self-reliance and self-independence and self-esteem and self-assuring that needs to be taught, you know, for us to survive in a place like America that constantly preys on our mind first and then, you know, attempts to take hold of our body, you know, through the actions of things and of our deeds and things of that nature. But, yeah, it's a interesting environment, and it's something that, you know, a lot of our children need to see. I remember in the early days when I first got here to Dallas, the big uproar with the DISD system, the Dallas Independent School District, and how it was being ran, and some parents did bring their children to the MUI system here in Dallas, and of course they were able to see a big difference, you know, with their children. So it's just, you know, I think the recurring theme tonight is we all have to roll up our sleeves and do something.
That's right.
You know, whatever our expertise is, whatever our ministry is, whatever our, you know, passion is, we just have to roll up our sleeves, or we will continue to see what we've been seeing. You know, just no way around it. You know, that's my take on it.
Yeah, I mean,
but then,
yeah, because
just that alone, we see that can be done. Just that alone, those things that we did, that we sent our children to homeschool. You know what I'm saying? We made that decision to make sure that our children are all right educationally. You know, so if we can do that, we can do the other things that we're talking about, you know, that you were talking about earlier. I think that's just a stand for what's right for black children right there, the education of our children.
Yes, ma'am. I mean, because we're being forced to separate. I think the stats say that there was a 5% increase in homeschooling between April and May of 2020, you know, then 16% in the fall of September and October of 2020. And, you know, I think some of the people saw that, hey, this is giving me calmer children. You know, I'm seeing less suspensions, less write-ups, because we still have to look at the backdrop of white supremacy that, you know, rules the law, because there's an author who did a study, a guy by the name of Slansky or something. He's a law professor, and he brought out the fact how the law treats violence in white America by looking at them as a product of their circumstances, black people are just seen as people who don't deserve sympathy because they just, you know, we're just violent. That's the label. That's the false label they put on us. They talk about genetic violent characteristics. You know, these are the false labeling, and it's perpetrated sometimes through the rap music, through the imaging, through the TV programs. And so actually, you know, separating from that mindset is just that, that's just where we are. If we want to, you know, continue in existence. I mean, we see with this latest, with this Rittenhouse trial, the white boy on trial got all kinds of conclusions and perceptions about him that was evidenced in that verdict that a black child would never get. We
would
look at the young
brothers
in Central Park Five. You know, we look at Tamir Rice, who had a toy gun. We look at poor Ahmaud Arbery, who had no weapon.
No gun.
And how he, you know, and it just goes on and on. So, you know, when are we're trying to also say, now, you know, rolling up our sleeves with a firm made-up mind as to maybe what's the best direction to take in unity, I think is another issue that I would like to make, especially when we're looking at the courts tonight. We talk about them intentionally blocking and using resources to keep families torn apart. So we're, you know, this makes me throw my hands up a lot of times and say we have to look at other solutions. So
but you
we're coming down to go
too,
ahead.
Just like you said, you know, because if the parents don't send the children to school, they get truant tickets. They have to go to court. That's called neglect, them not giving their education. So they get involved in there, you know. So it's like you said, it's everywhere. You know,
yeah,
and when it comes to
another,
all the children.
Yes, ma'am. That's right. Trying to control. I mean, and we go back to 2004, and I can even say today, you know, we see them attempting to give our children drugs that are experimental, you know, with some of what we see with these shots. But we can go back to 2004 where, you know, 14 different prescriptions given to one child. That was reported in the Houston Press. Children given drugs to make them more submissive. We had $4 million wasted in a year on drugs given to foster children in 2004, and that's when Carol Keaton Strayhorn was the comptroller. Children as young as three were prescribed mind-altering drugs. And so these children, this is in 2004. So, you know, now we're in 21.
It's still happening.
So what is that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's still happening, and it's happening
it's
at
still
a greater.
Because every child does, is not, you know, have that diagnosis of ADHD or ADD. You know, a lot of them just are smarter than the classroom, you know, and it's just, you know, you need to know what to do with a child with the brain that's moving, you know. And that means that they need to, you know, get drugged down. They need to, you know, figure out to put that energy someplace else. Maybe that, you know, classroom is not for them. Maybe they need to move further, maybe this. But nobody wants it because they have a set plan as to what your child is supposed to do. Oh, and they're not doing it. They're running around. They're doing this. Give them drugs. You know, and they write the orders and they give them drugs.
Again, trying to overwhelm our families. Always trying to figure out how to undermine our families. Instead of us letting us be parents for ourselves.
Yes, ma'am. And having our own rights as God-given, God-given rights, human rights, is what we're being attacked on. Because the stat out is saying, it says that, you know, black people comprise about 13% of the total population in America, 25% of youth in foster care. In Philadelphia, black children, 42% of the population and 65% of youth in foster care. So, you know, I think that's our problem. You know, disproportionately, some of us may be doing okay, but we've got to increase, you know, and put up protective measures so we can protect the community that wants to be helped. And those of us who are striving to do the best thing, you know, because this wickedness, as the Honorable Ms. Lois Farrakhan said, it has actually become a, it's iniquitous behavior, because people are at a point where they're doing things and they know that it's wrong. So at some point we're going to have to, you know, save ourselves and save our community who wants to build. And so that's another issue I know that we're dealing with. Yeah. But yeah, I am. You know, so those were just some of the issues we wanted to talk about tonight. The system that we're dealing with, and how we can best, like Brother Jihad said, roll up our sleeves and really come together and take care of each other, because we know that the poverty has become a bigger issue during the pandemic. Joblessness, evictions are going to potentially be looking. So, you know, tell us something about you all farm over at the National Black United Front. Don't y'all have a garden, Sister Faraha?
Yes, we do have a garden. It was put together by Brother Daniel, part of the National Black United Front, the Shaka Sankole garden, and so we were able to plant things, and definitely people come over and actually get from the garden to put food in their own homes. We also have garden grubs. We were having them once a month, but we kind of, because the winter months are coming, but that is where we come and your people learn about gardening, because that's what it is. That's what they are doing for ourselves and creating for ourselves and all of that, so that we can, because when the last blackout happened, it was so many people in the fast food places. If we had our own gardens, we and know that, you know, eating healthy, or we can, you know, to bring the food deserts, you know, to minimal, you know, where we can actually have food in our gardens, you know. So that garden is there to help people to learn to grow for themselves into their own home. And that's very important, because that's what all we used to do, was grow our own foods, you know. My daughter is in Africa. She decided to take her family, her and her husband, take their family to Africa. They live in Tanzania, Africa. They've been there a year now. And when I went there, everything is agricultural. They, you know, they grow everything. They eat everything from the land. It's just amazing to see. And so I was able to eat corn and other things from my daughter's garden, our big farm, you know. So it's just really, you know, but it's all agricultural. Everything there is for the community. And the president said, if you go hungry, it's because you want to, because there's food everywhere. You know, so, and since same thing, our children, they, you know, like they were playing another team, and the team was in from the country, you know, and those boys, they eat really good food. You know, our children, unfortunately, are living on ramen noodles and hot chips.
Yeah,
they need to know about nutrition. Yeah. So they need to know about nutrition for their bodies, because nutrition not only helps their bodies, their skin, their minds.
And their minds.
You know, and it helps their minds, good nutrition. So that's a part of our garden, too, teaching children about gardening for themselves so they can learn that food is nutrition and fuel for the body and the mind.
Your kitchen is your medicine cabinet. I know we are taught in the nation, you know, with the sisters, we learn in the can, you know, learning. We actually had a community canning class remember, Sister Sandera, I sent you a picture of my can, where, you know, preserving food. Because we're going into these grocery stores and we see that the food sources are kind of low. I mean, this is real.
Yes.
When we look at these problems approaching, this hunger and the ability to cook, you know, we definitely need to push that, because as Brother Jihad said, with the program on the radio station that was pushing black women, raising black women up, this is our opportunity to give our sisters those skills they need to help them be more sufficient. And being able to take care of their families, because some people didn't learn what we learned.
I say,
Baraha, you know, like you said, we were coming up, we were taught certain skills and homemaking skills.
To learn how to cook and to survive, you know. You know, our children, you know, they just give up because that survival skill. We had to learn how to do that, you know. And, you know, and that takes away from the family, too. Remember how we used to sit down to a table and eat with your family?
Yeah.
And that's when you'd be able to talk and learn and what you did today. Well, what's going on with you? Our children don't have that, you know.
Right.
Because, you know, we run out and get something. Mama working so hard trying to keep the bills going. Daddy doing something, this, that, and the other. Everybody goes to their room. Nobody, you know, that family cohesiveness, we have to get back.
Yeah.
Bring your family into your room. Sit down and talk about, hey, baby, what you doing, you know. You know, how is the day going? And you know, what did you learn? Or, you know, how can I help you? And in fact, they took everything out of school. We used to have all that in school.
Mm-hmm.
We had the home ec and we had the trades and all that. All that's gone, you know.
Yep.
And that's a problem, too, because all children aren't going to college. They need to learn some skills. Our children, they don't know how to build
basic
nothing.
Skills, right, some survival skills.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
So what happens to the land when they don't know how to build anything? So that's when, you know, we have to come in. We have to show our children how to do all that. So that's where the garden comes in. We're going to show you how to garden. We're going to show you what time of year to plant this and what you'll get the best yield from this and what nutrition that this has for you. All that's important, you know. And know that,
yes,
you know, the almanac was made by us for a reason.
Yes, ma'am, teach our history that, and how we are that
indeed.
Great people. And so, Sister Sandero, because we're actually down to our last couple of minutes, but I think Sister Faraha brought up a point how social workers are now being brought to the forefront and recognizing you all's role in helping to solve some of these problems that are treated as criminal, they're treated as, you know, just really dysfunctional, but really they're human service needs. And so I would advise or I would encourage any of us who know social workers, who have friendship, who have that training, you know, to combine that, because this penal system, this punitive system with everybody just being incarcerated, you know, the conflict resolution, as Brother Jihad said, is just horrible. So, you know, so important. Brother Jihad, we want to thank you. You know, having a male on our panel is always important for that perspective, because the black male is definitely the head of the family. And you y'all are so important to the preservation of the family. So, did you want to make any closing remarks? Yes, thank you. And go ahead.
Just real, I have just been, you know, I'm thankful to be a part of the presentation tonight. Anything we can do to help build a solution and prick the consciousness of our people and even us who are conscious to do more is great. So, you know, whether we reach one person, two people, 10, 100, what have you, you know, so I'm thankful. Just you know, solution building. Solution building is everything. And so I just implore us that the next young brother or young sister we see that looks like, you know, they're having a bad day or they don't want to be approached, or, you know, that we get in our heart to say something loving to them, and particularly our youth, and we will see them open up. You know, let's make that, you know, I'm sure all of us on the phone are already doing it, but perhaps if we, you know, forget, let's make that our weekly assignment this week. Find a young person and, you know, whether they're at a bus stop or you're going to a grocery store or whatever, and try to give them some degree of uplift with your presence. You know, it can make a difference, and that young person could be on the way to do something to take away their freedom and to cause bloodshed, you know, and end up in this wicked system. So, you know, I just implore us to just, you know, continue the solution build. And I thank y'all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for what you're doing.
Much. Right. So we're going to close out, and so we'll say thank you very much, all of you all, beautiful, beautiful, for joining us on A Time for Justice. I would like to say, if you'd like to hear previous shows, you can log on to Blog Talk Radio, The Elevated Places. I'd like to thank the Elevated Places team. I would like to thank Sister Dr. Ava Muhammad, and remind everyone to listen to her show on Thursday at 7 p.m. I'd like to also thank my producer, Sister Samaya Muhammad, and thank you all once again for listening. Please tune in next week for more informative discussions. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum.